Ladies and gentlemen, it's a pleasure to welcome to the Solier Report Howard Rood, who is the CEO of Vascular Solutions, which is a successful medical device company based in Minnesota. After practicing law, Howard started the company and built it into a successful publicly traded company with 500 employees and a very diverse line of medical devices. And then in 2011, he was targeted in a five-year investigation and prosecution by the Department of Justice in a case of prosecutorial abuse, which is an excellent example of what I believe is one of the key things destroying productivity in America. Interestingly enough, he fought hard and he won. It's a remarkable story. It took 5 years, $25 million in legal fees. And after he won, he did something even more remarkable. He turned around and co-authoring it with one of the young attorneys who worked on his case, he wrote and very quickly published a book called Cardiac Arrest, which tells the story. It's a true story. And I have to tell you, it's a legal thriller. I could not put it down. I read it this weekend in anticipation of doing this interview. And if you enjoy the drama of a very exciting court case, you don't want to miss it. It's extraordinary. And as I said, it's a very good example of what I think is destroying productivity in America. He ends the book with some excellent suggestions of what we can all do. And I just have to say before bringing him on, this is a man who has done a great service for all of us by fighting, by winning, and then living to tell the tale. So, Howard Root, welcome to the Solier Report.
Well, thanks for that that very nice introduction. I really appreciate it. And the one postscript to it, the one thing I did after writing the book is I actually sold the company, and we can go into the reasons for that. But now I'm in my second week of retirement at the age of 56, which is a lesson all by itself. My wife is worried I'm going to be spending too much time at home. I'm trying to make sure that I don't interrupt her perfect life here. But yeah, into the second week of retirement for me.
Okay. Well, I knew you sold it, but I didn't know if you had closed, and I didn't know if you were pulling right out right away or staying a little bit on. But reminds me of one of my clients when he first sold his company. He said, "I'm too young to be a has-been."
Yeah, my wife says I married you for life, not for lunch. So it's in the middle of the day.
Oh, I'm sure you will. Well, why don't we step back and talk about how you came to write this book, and in the process, tell us a little bit about the company and its business, the people, the product, so we have the background.
So yeah, so the writing of the book, it's one of those things is you get into stuff, and everyone always has the idea, hey, I'm going to write a book at some point in time, but you know, no one's going to read the book. And so as I got into this case a little bit and as it started to unfold, I just went from a crazy idea I should write a book to it's kind of useful for me at the end of the week just to jot down my notes of what went on and keep files of everything together, because that's kind of therapy as you're getting into something, and it helps clarify my thoughts to. I was actually putting it into chapters and doing some writing, but I never was that great of a creative writer, as factual writer, more legally trained. And then all of a sudden getting associated with a young associate, Steve Saltarelli, who was on the case, who said he was going to leave the practice of law after the case, not because of the case, but just after the case, and wanted to be a screenwriter and was going to live in his parents' basement in St. Louis for 6 months while he tried to get some money to move out to L.A., And it seems like everything comes together perfectly. You know, you've got the chapter, you've got the material, you've got the documents, and you've got a young guy who's eager to write everything and craft it. And between the two of us, it took us about 6 months, but it was great therapy to get kind of everything put together and tell it in a story and then have him put it in a way that, it just makes it easier for the reader, I think, to go through. It's 100% factually correct. We've got a lot, as you read, a lot of the court transcripts are in there, which is real helpful for writing a courtroom drama because you got the transcripts. And we were real happy. And then at the end, it was just a tough slog. Anyone who's written anything, the beginning is fun, and then the middle is kind of painful, and the end is pure drudgery as you try to make sure you get everything just so. But I'm happy.
Well, it's interesting you said that he wanted to be a screenplay writer, because it's very, one of the things that really makes it a thriller is it's very action-packed, and now that you say he wanted to be a screenplay author, it makes a lot more sense, because it's written in that sort of movie kind of feel. There's a sense of action the whole way through.
Right, and it's three acts. It's the symptoms, the diagnosis, and the treatment, taking the medical all the way through, and the way he crafted in small chapters and interplayed things. And don't try to tell it just in a pure chronological story. I was born in Minneapolis in 1960. No, that's not the way to do it. And he really did a good job of putting the chapters in the right order to make it interesting, I think. So kudos to him for that.
So tell us a little bit about the company so we have the background on the what happened in 2011.
Right. So back in 1997, early 97, I decided that I wanted to chase the American dream. I'd been trained as a lawyer. I had worked inside a medical device company here in Minneapolis, Minnesota, where there are a lot of medical device companies. And I thought, you know, I know enough. I was 35 years old. I said, I can try to do this on my own. And so I took $300 that I had and didn't have a lot more money than that and incorporated a company and went out and tried to find an idea from a doctor that I could make into this company I wanted to create. And I found a doctor in California. I licensed in his idea, gave him some money and some stock. I went to people I knew from the corporate finance area and raised about $1.5 million and started Vascular Solutions in February of 1997. So exactly 20 years ago is when we got started. We had that one device. We brought that on the market in 2000. We raised venture capital. We went public in July of 2000. The first product launched. We created a U.S. sales force. We got beat up a little bit by competitors. Our stock price high of $26 a share went down to 70 cents a share. But we battled through it. The doctor left the company, but I had a good group of people that I worked with to invent some other devices. And I turned from a manager to more of a medical device developer to an inventor. And from 2003 and through 2016, we launched over 100 new medical devices. We went from zero in revenue at the start all the way up to about 180 million in revenue last year. Nicely profitable. Our stock price went up to $56 a share, and we ended up selling it for $1 billion to a big medical device company called Teleflex out in Philadelphia just a couple weeks ago. So it's one of those great, you know, American-only kind of success stories where you can start from $300 and build a company with, at the end, 650 employees, 100 new medical devices that, you know, help people treat medical conditions like anything from a heart attack to varicose veins. And it's really it's kind of what we're known for in the Twin Cities, kind of medical alley, is creating these medical device companies. Unfortunately, there's not many of them left anymore.
So before we talk about what happened and how you ended up in your sort of squabble with the Department of Justice, I want to step back and look at the what you refer to at the end of cardiac arrest as the criminalization of America. We've had several decades with federal and, to a certain extent, state and local enforcement creating what I would describe as the for-profit enforcement model, where you're incentivizing other people to, quote-unquote, blow the whistle, or you're incentivizing your enforcement bureaucracy to make money targeting a variety of different private sector people or companies. And you were a target of a QI-TAM lawsuit. So maybe if you could just talk a little bit about the, you know, the Department of Justice for-profit model and the QI-TAM in particular.
Yeah, so there's two parts to that. The Department of Justice boasts about how much money they make fighting healthcare fraud. It's number two in their most profitable endeavors. Number one is financial fraud. And when I talked about my case to investors, I always say I'm number two, which means that you're number one in the target list. And they actually talk about a return on investment. They claim in their last annual press release, they claim 610% return on investment in fighting healthcare fraud, which means for every dollar they invest, they get $6.10 back. Which, to me, the first time I read that, I was just appalled that anyone in the Department of Justice who actually spends time calculating their financial return, I mean, you know, I was a lawyer. I look at these, with the amount of power that you have in the federal government, you could extract any amount of money from any business any day. You could just walk into someone, flash your badge, and say, give me $1 million, and you'd get $1 million. That doesn't make it right. And so they've got this incentive. And you know, that's the department itself. We say, well, what about the prosecutors? They don't get that money. And everyone thinks that greed is only about money. But the greed for money at the Department of Justice is just to allow them to do what they want to do, which is prosecute people with their mission. I mean, a lot of these people are motivated by trying to find a CEO of a public company to throw in prison. And that's the way they get promoted. You know, another way of looking at it, they've got a press release they do every year where they talk about the awards ceremony they have. And in the awards ceremony, the Department of Justice, over 300 awards, all of them for big convictions, big settlements, big money. Not one for an exoneration. And if you're incentivizing only one part of conduct, you're going to get more of that, and you won't get the opposite side. It's just astonishing to me. You go back to Attorney General Robert H. Jackson in 1940, wrote a great speech he gave to U.S. attorneys called The Prosecutor, where he said, even at that time, everyone in America can be accused of a crime and could be indicted of a crime by a grand jury any day. So the prosecutor's job is to only pick those that are the most certain, most harmful, the most clear violations of the law, and go after those. But everything else, you can't go after. In fact, you know, we should decriminalize that. But even if they are criminal behavior, prosecutors with that kind of power to go after anyone with the machinery and the money behind them, it's an infinite amount of money they could get, and they're incentivized to do just that. Then you combine with that the other side is the whistleblowers and the QUITAM.
Right.
Because this whole QUITAM process assumes that disgruntled former employees are always noble, that they have some dirt on the company and they're going to turn that over to the government. So the way it works is an employee who has some complaint about the company doesn't even have to send it into the company. All they have to do is go to the U.S. Attorney's Office, file a complaint in the name of the government, and the U.S. Attorneys will pick that up and investigate it. And if the U.S. Attorney actually intervenes, they will take over the complaint, they will prosecute it, and the whistleblower will get somewhere around 25% to 30% of whatever shakedown the government can get. So it's incredibly profitable for these people, and that's how my whole case started, is a disgruntled former employee starting a civil lawsuit, which at the same time as the civil lawsuit is intervened by the government, the government also starts a parallel criminal investigation.
Right.
When I saw the whole thing play out, and I didn't know about it till about 3 years into it, I was just astonished at how this system works to take just a disgruntled employee's complaint and turns it into a criminal prosecution of a CEO.
Well, there are two things I wanted to bring up about this. One is that what I saw in Washington was you had real pressure from the appropriations committees. The more money you bring in this way, the more we'll provide you for your budget. So one of the ways you could grow your budget was to, you know, the more of this you could generate, the more you could get in terms of, so it was almost like a commission racket. But the second thing, and you see it very clearly in your case, is that the vast majority of these cases never go to trial. And so the settlement business, you can bring a case against somebody who's basically innocent, because for most companies, it's going to be more profitable to pay you to go away. It's a green mail. It's a form of government green mail. And so it really becomes sort of a Sheriff of Nottingham shakedown that, as you point out in the book, rarely, rarely goes to trial.
Yeah, you can look at it. What companies are going to withstand a government investigation? If you're too small, which means I spent $25 million on my defense, and maybe half of that was wasted, but who knows which half I wasted and which half was well spent. And say you have to spend $10 million. I mean, 95% plus, maybe even 99% of businesses in America could not spend $10 million to defend themselves. So they're out. Without the right lawyer, you're not going to win. You're done. Now, the big companies, would they pay $1 billion to get out of an indictment of their CEO? Well, absolutely. So the big companies will pay because they can. The small companies will pay whatever they can. And it's only if you're in that middle section where you have an ability to pay the defense, but you have a small enough company where you're willing to say, no, we're going to go to battle and we can weather the storm. Financial companies can't even weather the storm. If the government indicts a bank, the bank loses its deposits right away. If a government indicts a hospice center, they can get they'll get Medicare pulled right away. So there's so much power without even getting to the courtroom to destroy a business that, as you say, 99% of these claims get paid out irrespective of whether you did anything right or wrong.
Right, and that's why I was so impressed reading the book that you had decided to really take this on and got all the different constituencies to support you. Well, I'm getting ahead, so let's introduce us to the original investigation and settlement proposals, and then the indictment.
Right. So it starts with, and the way this happens was, one of our sales reps decides that he wants to be promoted. He applies. He does not get the promotion. He becomes disgruntled. He quits. He starts competing with us. I send him a letter to stop. He sends a letter back saying we're illegal and harassing him and discriminating against him, all these kind of things, wide range of things. I look into it, have our guy look into it, our lawyer look into it, nothing there. Send back a letter saying, please provide me with specifics. He never sends anything back in. Instead, he files the qui tam lawsuit. Because his lawyer says, hey, if we make this big enough, you'll get enough money. And the disgruntled employee was desperate. He was just, he had all kinds of bad situations, divorce, allegations of child abuse, and all kinds of things. He's just destroyed. You don't even want to, you know, get associated with these people. But the government did. And from there, the government believed his fable. He had created a fable of $20 million in damages over a product that our grand total of sales was $500,000. I mean, how you get that kind of damages out of a product that small is beyond me. 0.1% of our sales, FDA approved not just once, but 8 times, and it never harmed a single patient. No allegations right. of any patient. What right. they claimed was that our sales reps were saying the wrong word about this product, a product used to treat varicose veins. This whistleblower said we were talking about treating perforator varicose veins as opposed to saphenous varicose veins, and because of that, it turned a legal product sale into a crime. Now, for some reason, these prosecutors in San Antonio, which is where the sales rep brought his complaint, decided that this was the case to be made. And they dug into it and they believed the whistleblower. And then they continued to investigate. They sent me a subpoena. We gave them 1 million pages of documents. I offered to sit down and talk with them because I saw that they were going down the wrong path. They were believing false information. They had the meeting scheduled 2 days before they canceled it. Instead, they were trying to build their case before they even talked to me. In fact, they never did talk to me before they indicted me. So it gets to a point where they're already bought in. They're already dug in. They're already advocates for the other side. And then they come to you with a settlement proposal. And the settlement right. proposal is the company pleads guilty to a crime. The company pays $20 million. And the CEO gets excluded from his company, which means that I'm never going to work in healthcare again. For something that I didn't do, that I didn't tell anyone to do, that if they did say the word perforator, it's not even a crime. Well, you know, that's crazy. I mean, why would I do that? That's
well, my first question is, who was the hedge fund that wanted to pick up the stock and the company cheap?
Yeah. Well, you know, we didn't have any of that, surprisingly, but we did have plenty of plaintiffs' securities law firms wanting to sue us. And so they'd get right. someone to buy the stock, 10 shares, just waiting for the fall. But, you know, the financial people actually stood behind us fairly strongly, and we did a stock repurchase plan, so when this became public, that the stock didn't drop that far.
Right.
You worry about that because it's easily manipulated. But in this case, I don't think we had that, actually.
Well, one of the things I thought was so impressive is if you look at all the different constituencies involved for your company, so the attorneys, the investors, the board, the employees, the customers, you seem to have done a remarkable job of keeping everybody in the tent. For example, I have to tell you, one of the things that most impressed me about your performance running the company was the board that you clearly recruited and managed, because the way they managed it was uniquely both competent and virtuous. I was amazed. Thought, how did he do it? Well, how did you do it, Howard? I want to know.
So this is one of those things, you go through life, and I'm sure you've done this too, is where you do something and then you move away from that, you're doing something else, you move away from that, and you wonder if everything you've ever done in your life will ever come together into a seminal moment where you use all of your experience at one time. And I don't think it happens that often. This happened for me. I was trained as a lawyer, a corporate securities lawyer, so I knew corporate governance and I knew how to put together boards and how boards should act and the rights and responsibilities. I'd gone through litigation, so I knew kind of what the process was, although I hadn't gone through criminal, I'd gone through civil litigation, so I knew what the lawyers would do and what they do well and what they do poorly. You know, and I also was the founder of the company since the beginning, so I put all these board members on, and I made sure that they saw what we were doing. And most importantly, I was an Eagle Scout growing up, and I never did anything wrong, so I didn't have any skeletons in the closet for them to look right. at and go, well, we don't trust him. Because, right. you know, I'm so fortunate because most boards of directors, almost all of them, will look at that, and they get the settlement offer, and the settlement offer is, if you plead guilty to this, you will be done with those expenses, you will not have any risk of destroying your company, and you'll be able to move on with your business. But all you have to do is fire your CEO. And most board members go, well, we represent the shareholders, and the best interest of the shareholders is probably to take the death sentence off the table. And it is a death sentence. If we had lost, they could have excluded us from selling to any hospital that takes Medicare patients, which is
right.
every hospital in America. Our business
right.
could be shut down by the federal government for a misdemeanor conviction in a case that didn't involve any harm to any patient, and it was about an FDA-approved product. But the board will say, minimize the risk, minimize the downside. That's what businesses always do. And if you do that, you end up throwing good people under the bus.
Right.
And I had to make that very clear to the board at the start as to how the path was going to go, and then lay out for them a course of action that I thought we could follow to victory, and then make sure that the lawyers didn't get in the way. And I've told a lot of board members, I've seen more corporations destroyed by their own lawyers than by the other side's lawyers.
That is absolutely true. Yeah, and it was very lucky for you that you had practiced the law, because one of the things you did was you kept evolving your team until you got the right group of attorneys.
Yeah,
and I think that was critical.
Look at it, the first lawyer quit on me. The second lawyer I fired because he wasn't that good. The third lawyer was pretty good, but not as good as was junior partner, who I promoted up. So quit, fired, demoted, and it was the fourth lawyer on the case for the company that gave the opening and closing argument. But
which I have to tell you is the best closing argument I have ever read or heard. I'm not going to say anything more about it because everybody should get the book and read it.
Right. It's hard to summarize. But what he did
was
amazing.
It's one of those moments where I was laughing so hard, I was like pounding the chair. And I have a big picture window, and I thought, uh-oh, my neighbors must see me. It was amazing. Yeah.
It was a year ago Sunday was the closing argument. So it's been 1 year since the not guilty verdict now. So
wow.
I still remember it like it was yesterday.
Now, another thing you describe is how, your employees are looking at you. Your employees, the first thing they do is they get scared.
Right.
And it takes them a while to kind of settle in and realize, how to deal effectively. And it requires a lot of patience on your part, I know. But it seems like your employees finally settled in and got it and came around. But you showed a lot of patience, I thought, in working with them through this.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really tough. This is one of the biggest differences between criminal and civil lawsuits. Civil lawsuits, I always pull all the employees who are involved together, and we sit down with the lawyers and we go over it, so they know all the facts of where we're going. And even if they don't understand the law, they see
right.
me and the lawyers setting out a course of action so they can put their mind at rest. But in criminal investigations, the government makes every employee a potential target. And therefore,
right.
that employee has to have its own counsel, his or her own counsel.
Right.
Then the employee is told by the lawyer, don't talk to Howard about the case. Don't talk to
right.
anyone at the company about your case. And we don't, they don't know from me what I'm doing, but the lawyer for them is guessing what I'm doing and usually getting it partially wrong. And yet I'm working with these employees day to day about our business, and they're looking at me thinking, is Howard going to sell me out? Is he going to make
right.
me the scapegoat for this thing? Is
right.
And you just got to look at them with all the confidence without talking about it and saying, I've got this. I've got it covered.
Right.
Don't worry
right.
about it. But, how many times can you take just those kind of recitations from someone and actually believe it? If you make the mistake, your career might be over. You might be bankrupt. You might be in prison. And your lawyer
right.
is saying, don't trust anyone because you might be the next one to get indicted and you might be the one who's going to go to prison. So I got to give respect to the employees. There are some employees who got swayed, I would put it politely, by the prosecutor's threats and had to sign
right.
statements that they knew weren't true because the
right.
employee thought, well, if I sign it, I have immunity. If I don't, I might get convicted or excluded or fired. I'll sign whatever you put in front of my nose. Especially former employees will do that. Current, not
right.
so much. But then when
right.
we got them on the stand and they were getting ahead of ourselves and we got to the trial, those type of forced confessions become really great arguments for the defense. Because
yes.
jurors are just everyday average people who, when they see prosecutors threatening the children of employees,
right.
just lose it on what is going on in this courtroom, supposedly in a search for justice.
It's interesting. I always describe this kind of situation as it's imagine for a second a Ferrari. You spent decades building this wonderful high performance company, and it's performing in the market, and it's the whole culture is high performance. And then it comes into contact with the Sheriff of Nottingham's culture, which is walking, talking entropy. And it's a little bit like pouring saltwater taffy into a Ferrari engine, and then you have to keep driving the Ferrari despite the saltwater taffy pouring into the engine. And it's remarkable, as you describe, going back and forth between dealing with the litigation and running the company. You can see you struggling with keeping that car going despite the sort of culture of entropy that keeps hiccuping you. And I don't know, you clearly had a picture of how you were going to win this and just kept going forward. Okay, so tell us a little bit about the trial and the acquittal.
Okay, so we get to trial, and all the way up to the trial, the government has all the power. A grand jury would indict a ham sandwich if a prosecutor wanted them to, and that's absolutely true. I mean, the employees go into the grand jury room with no lawyer, there's no judge, the prosecutor asks whatever question, no rules of evidence, and then at the end of the session, they bring the investigator from the government in front of the jury, grand jury, and they ask the investigator, "Do you think a crime's occurred?" The investigator always says yes, and then they ask the grand jury to indict reasonable cause for a suspicion of a crime. The grand jury is going to say yes every time, so that's no
Right.
check. So you get indicted, and then you have to go down to San Antonio and get booked in like a common criminal, and then you get a pretrial probation officer, which is going to take away your guns and weapons and make sure that you're not going to run to Mexico. Although my guy actually said if the charges were any worse, he would have recommended that I run to Mexico in order to get out of this, which was one of those stunning moments. You talk about an epiphany in the middle of a speech. This was an epiphany
Right.
for me in the middle of a booking, is when my pretrial probation officer says, "I haven't seen a lot of guys like you. These are bad charges. I'd say keep going to Mexico, Howard, and leave." And he was the nicest guy I met in San Antonio. So you're going through that whole process, and they set the schedule, and they delayed it, and they figure out where it's going to be. We tried to move it back to Minnesota because we had no connection to San Antonio on this thing at
Right.
all. The judge keeps it down there because the judge is next door neighbors to the prosecutor, so he doesn't want the prosecutor to come up to a Minnesota winter for the trial, rather bring us down for a San Antonio summer, right? Ends
Right.
up getting delayed a little bit more, and then all of a sudden, the day the trial starts, February 1, 2016, you walk into the courtroom, and the power shifts. And it's the most
Right.
amazing thing in a business thing, because all of a sudden, now you're in a situation where the prosecution has to prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt.
Right, it has to have evidence.
They have to have evidence. They
Right.
have to they have to put everything out there. They have to explain it to 12 ordinary Americans of what this
Right.
is and what this. Now, they may think this is a crime, but try to explain to Americans how saying the word perforator makes the CEO go to prison, and they'll scratch their heads. And then when you
Right.
start talking about threatening people to get them to sign statements, they'll really wrinkle their brow and furrow their brow. And then all of a sudden, you start saying there's no harm here, there's no one who's been hurt, and they're wondering, why are we here for 3 weeks?
Right.
And that's one of the things. Plus, the jury strikes, and how when you're selecting a jury, we had a great jury consultant that came in and worked with us and profiled, and we did 3 mock trials. We had the money to spend to do this stuff that most normal defendants don't, and it's just
Right.
amazing what you get out of that. So we could figure out what jurors we wanted, what jurors we didn't want. We got the ones we wanted on the jury, and then we see the prosecutors actually start talking. And as bad as they were in investigating this, as much mistaken evidence they believed, they were even worse at presenting what they thought they knew. And just stumbling,
See,
bumbling lawyers
you're
in front of
nicer.
them.
I don't think they ever thought they had a real case. I don't think they really thought there was anything here. I just think they thought that they could make money, that it was a shakedown, and then they never were able, they thought in the investigation they could find something, and they couldn't find anything, and then they were forced, you forced them to go to trial, and then they were in real trouble.
Yeah, you might be right. I never really considered that, because I always. The way I approach things, I always assume it's going to go all the way through, and I'm surprised if it stops short. But these two main prosecutors, Bud and Tim, they had a combined total over the last 10 years of trials, real trials, of 2. between the two of them, they'd done two trials in the last 10 years. So they'd won everything by other side giving up. And when we didn't give up, they were forced to actually prove it. They're not suited for that. They're not geared for that at all.
Right.
And so they were just woefully unprepared, completely unpersuasive. And our lawyers, by then, we were practicing our opening and getting everything geared and having them set up and binders upon binders of cross-examination materials. And just it got worse and worse and worse for the prosecutors.
Now, before you went to trial, one of your attorneys filed with the Office of Professional Ethics at the Department of Justice. Is that true? Was it before the trial?
Yeah, we did. We brought, you know, before the indictment, we sent something into Maine Justice, the Department of Justice headquarters in Washington, D.C., going all the way up to Joyce Branda, who is Assistant Attorney General, saying, you should take a look at this because these prosecutors are engaged in a malicious prosecution, pursuing false information with a non-crime. And we laid out in about a 20-page letter exactly what they were wrong on, which was exactly what happened at trial. And I was a little worried about that because you never want to show the other side how they're wrong before they get in the courtroom. But we thought maybe we could get someone in Maine Justice to be the adult and actually, you know, look at these prosecutors and say, stand down, stop this nonsense, back away, you're going to lose. And they didn't. I also went to our senator, our local senator, Senator Amy Klobuchar here in Minnesota, and tried to get her involved because this is just radical prosecutorial misconduct in my view. I'm just extreme to the point of where they were taking grand jury testimony of one witness and reading it to another witness. Now that's black letter law violation. The former Attorney General of Pennsylvania is in prison for doing that. And these prosecutors admitted that that's what they did and they had no explanation for it. Yet it continued to go on, and the Office of Professional Responsibility at DOJ is part of DOJ, and it's staffed by DOJ lawyers who rotate in between prosecuting and being in charge of ethics. Well, you can't imagine a worse conflict of interest than that. You know, the Office of Inspector General is an independent agency of the government that reports to the Senate Judiciary Committee, which would be much better. You know, that's one of my recommendations. That's who should be investigating prosecutorial misconduct, but not now, not today. And those appeals that we made went absolutely nowhere. One-hour meeting was all we got at Maine Justice, and then Joyce Branda kicked it back to San Antonio and said, you deal with the prosecutors down there. The same guys we accused of prosecutorial misconduct were the ones who were supposed to decide whether to follow through on the trial or not. And so they decided to go ahead.
My theory, I know this isn't your theory, this is my theory. I think the reason you got, you know, a top D.C. judge sent down there to handle the trial is because they knew they had a mess. So I think there was a connection between your filing there and your suddenly getting a new judge, which probably worked to your advantage.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, so we got Judge Royce Lamberth, who I was really excited about getting, but he's a San Antonio native and he comes down there every winter. And I think the reason is Judge Fred Beery was our first judge, and as we found out pretty quickly, Judge Beery does not like to work all that much, and this would be a complicated trial. He likes to do his gardening in the afternoon and play basketball at lunchtime, and as long as his courtroom activity doesn't interfere with gardening or basketball, he's fine with it. But this is going to be 5 weeks of nonstop trial.
Real work.
Yeah. So when Royce Lamberth comes down, and Royce Lamberth is a big First Amendment guy. I mean, he's a Reagan appointee, which means, you know, he's conservative and he's old. He's been on the bench since the early 80s, I think it was. And when he came down, I was excited, but and not to cut to the chase, the problem with conservative judges is if you get convicted, they're hanging judges. I mean, they're pretty by the book. And Judge Lamberth, I found out later, has not had an acquittal in his courtroom in over 10 years. In 10 years, I was the first one. And that's because the government doesn't lose very much. And as we found out at trial, Judge Lamberth makes it pretty tough for the defendant's counsel. He gives a lot of leeway to the prosecutors and cuts you pretty close on the defense evidence. And that made us pretty concerned.
Well, you have no idea how disappointed I was. He wouldn't let the tower in the courtroom.
Yeah. they're talking about these trip reports, these weekly reports from one of my 100 sales reps that I get, and this trip report on the third page said the word perforator, and didn't you read that, and didn't you know that, Howard? And we wanted to prove that, you know, there's so many of these reports, you won't scour it for one word on the third page, and the way to prove that was a six-foot tower of paper that was just 1 year's worth of trip reports that I could have had access to. And he wouldn't even let it in. He wouldn't even let us show that to the jury, to what it means to have 20,000 pieces of paper and how big that looks. But it wasn't, you know, it wasn't the most important piece of evidence, but it was my own visual aid that I created. So I was kind of disappointed we didn't get to show it. So,
but so then they present the prosecutors present their case, and rather than you then presenting your case, you closed there. So tell us about that. Tell us,
yeah. The way that's set up was as they start calling their witnesses. So they call the branch chief at the FDA to testify, and this is a guy who's over the examiner who reviewed our applications, and this is someone who's had 20 plus years of experience at the FDA. And on cross examination, our lawyer asks him, now, this approval for this product covers varicose veins, correct? And he says, correct. And that could include perforator veins, couldn't it? And he says, it could. And at that point, you stand
the case is over.
The case is over, yeah. He just admitted that the approval could cover what they claim the illegal act was. So if it covers perforator veins, talking about it is on label, which means it's not a crime. We had FDA approval for what they claimed we didn't have FDA approval for. So you go, okay, well, that's good. Okay, check the box there. I don't think we need another one of those. And then they put a doctor on to talk about this product, and they want to make it sound like it's so dangerous. And on cross-examination, we ask them, have you used this product? Oh, yeah, for 11 years. What do you think? Oh, it's safe and effective. It's a wonderful product. I've never had a problem with it. And those complications that the prosecutors talk about, those are all theoretical, never seen it, purely hypothetical. If you talked about it the way they talked about it, you'd be deceiving the customer. You'd be making it out to be scare tactics. Well, check the box. We don't need another doctor to testify. And then they get into our employees, and our employees are saying, no, Howard would never do anything wrong. Howard is very compliant. He's really by the book. He would tell people to follow the law over profit any day of the week. Check. We've got the character witness in. And so you get done with that, and you go, well, now what else are we going to do? And the only thing that I obviously wanted, I wanted to testify. And this was the agonizing thing, I thought, is if we don't call our witnesses, that means I don't get to testify. And if we win, that's fine. But if we lose and I did not testify, it would be the worst feeling that would be with me for the rest of my life. Because I'd always think, if they'd only gotten me on the stand and I looked at the jury and I said, this is what I did, this is how I operate, this is who I am, they would connect with me. And I thought for sure that they would not convict me. But
so that's why you wrote the book, so you could testify.
Yeah, that's right. It's great to be able to tell your story, I know, to pull it all together and not have it lingering. But, you know, in the end, we decided the best thing to do is to cut the trial short by 3 weeks. The prosecutors had gone on for 3 weeks. At that point, they rested. We rested. We kind of caught them by surprise because they were getting ready for our witnesses, and we were all prepared for closing arguments. And so then our same lawyer smoked them with the closing arguments. They fumbled and bumbled with their closing argument, and the jury came back not guilty on all counts. So it ended the right way. And the beautiful thing is, when you win a case without calling a witness, it's hard to say it was a fluke or it was a close call. I mean, you can't explain that other than the government had no case, and they were not willing to walk away. They were just so blinded by their own passion and not justice, that they were willing to pursue it, even though they had no chance of winning.
Right. It's hard for people to believe that this happens, but it happens, and unfortunately, I believe it happens a lot. So,
right. I have.
And your final.
When I give talks about it, I have the first slide that I show is a Lionel Trilling quote. It says, "It is now life and not art that requires the willing suspension of disbelief." Because when I talk about this, people just can't believe it happens. And then if they really don't believe that you have to have a willing suspension of disbelief to believe life, then I say, well, if a year ago I told you President Donald Trump, would you believe that? Of course not. So things happen today that you can't believe, but you got to be open to it as long as you see the evidence. You don't, and the evidence is there. I mean, this is what happened in real time. I wasn't sugarcoating it or just picking
right.
the best parts. They prosecuted me for something that they could not prove was a crime, and they continued it all the way through trial. We did not call a witness. And not only,
right.
only did the jury say not guilty, one juror said that what the government did to me, my company, my employees, is nothing short of criminal. She wanted
right.
to put the prosecutors behind bars, not me.
Well, it was. I'm sure that they broke laws in the process, but they just felt that they, if they could keep doubling down on their bluff, that it would work, and they were wrong.
Yeah.
So one of my favorite parts of cardiac arrest is your description of how you came to the conclusion that the risk equation had changed in a very profound way, and you decided to sell your company. I thought that was quite remarkable, because you're talking about a very deep phenomena, which I believe is having major impact all over the country.
Right. Yeah, you know, we talk about regulation and the overregulation, the regulatory state and the fourth branch of government, and that's bad. That's really bad. But if you combine that with the Department of Justice that wants to put CEOs behind bars, now you've got criminalization of American business. And when I realized that if the sales rep says the wrong word, a prosecutor could indict me, and if I had lost this trial, I would have done 3 years behind bars minimum. And you have to serve
right.
85% of that sentence in federal prison. So I'm sitting there thinking, do I really want to run that risk again? You know, and now that I've beaten the government, I'm going to talk about it. It's not like I'm not a conspiracy theorist. On the other hand, I know that if they had some additional whistleblower allegation against me after what I had done to them, people in the Department of Justice would put their A team on it and not give up and want me, you know, as you know, my head
right.
on a platter. And
yeah, you won because you had the C team.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, because
yeah.
if I flipped it around and our lawyers were on the other side, I think I'd be in prison today. You know, you just, the power is so massive on the government side. Now, on the other hand,
right.
if you'd flipped it around and my lawyers were on the other side, as they were 10 years ago when they worked in the Department of Justice, they would not have prosecuted me because
right.
they're intelligent and honest people. But if you get a dishonest, a poorly motivated prosecutor in the Department of Justice who's got competence, I could go to prison. I go, no. I mean, I was not motivated by money to start the company. I was a very successful lawyer. I had a secure job and future. I wanted to do this to do something more important with my life. I mean, that's just,
right.
I mean, it sounds corny, but that's what I wanted to do. I enjoy developing medical devices. We've invented and developed over 100 medical devices. A third of those were my ideas. We're working with the U.S. Army to make freeze-dried plasma, which they haven't had since the Vietnam War, but is useful to save soldiers' lives on the battlefield. And,
right.
and that's very rewarding, but it's not enough for me to risk going to jail because a salesperson said the wrong word.
Right.
You know, and you say, well, you know, and a lot of the medical device people go, well, Howard, just amp up your compliance, get more compliance. And it's like,
no
you cannot comply your
yeah.
way out of this. There's no way.
Right.
And
right.
every business, you know, Harvey Silverglade wrote a book called Three Felonies a Day, and it's true. Every business in America commits at least three felonies a day. And the only question is, which ones are the prosecutors going to go after? Now, I made the decision to sell before Trump was elected, and I thought Hillary was for sure coming in, and I don't know if it would have made that much difference, but when I was looking at what happened with Obama and what was happening with Clinton and where this was headed, I said, let's find a good exit, and the good exit means me out of the CEO chair, and to do that the right way for the company and everyone else is to sell the company to a bigger corporation. And this is what's
right.
happening in America. Small companies are selling out. It's very hard to get started, very hard to be successful, and when you get there, you say it's not worth it, you sell out, and then at 56, I say, I'm not going to do it again. If I do
right.
anything, I'm going to be in a much lower profile role in business, and I probably won't even do that because I don't need
right.
to do it for the money, and I don't do it for the fun now because it just there's too much risk. It's too much other stuff you have to do, and that's, you know, we're going to become a stagnant economy as we already are, and people aren't going to be creating new jobs, and then people are going to be wondering, why is that happening? Well,
right.
there's a pretty good answer staring them in their face right there.
Right. Yeah, if the sheriff of Nottingham is roaming around, it's not worth it. Cui bono, we talked about who benefits, and clearly, you know, there was something going on at the Department of Justice trying to make their targets and awards in medical devices, but You know, there are many different uses of both the QI-TAM and other enforcement actions. I don't know if you've ever read, Matt Taibbi has a book called Divide, and one of the chapters is on the targeting by the Department of Justice of a Canadian insurance company, Fairfax Financial, which is a fascinating story. But they were basically working with short sellers, and and you had people, you know, and I've seen other examples where you had a lead investor who wanted to pick the company up cheap, and so they wanted a jam so that they could end up taking control. And, you know, there are many different fact patterns, but unfortunately, you get a Department of Justice trying to make money and then partnering with people in the private sector working together to target, you know, a healthy company. And so it makes, it's kind of like the unhealthy making money destroying the healthy. And
They have to find someone who's got some information. The one thing the Department of Justice does not have is original sources of information. And so they have to find someone who's got that. And they found it in whistleblowers. They can find it in short sellers. They can find it in plaintiff securities law firms. And any of those that are paid for the information they give to the Department of Justice, that information has to be highly suspect. Anyone who's getting paid for their information, you question the veracity of the information. But not at the Department of Justice. And there's a lot of good whistleblowers. I don't want to say that any whistleblower is bad. And there's some bad companies out there. And companies that have do criminal things, and CEOs who deserve to go to prison, and Bernie Madoff belongs behind bars, and that's the problem. Is when I take my position, they go, "But Howard, do you want just a lawless West where everyone has no No, no one would advocate for that. But that doesn't justify the other side, which is you take a disgruntled employee's allegations, and without talking to the CEO, you amp it up into a full investigation where you've got your hooks in so tight that you can't give up. And you're going to indict him without even talking to him, and then you go to trial and you lose completely without the other side presenting its case. That system is broken. It's broken completely, and it has very bad effects on American business and the American economy. And it's, I think, the number one thing that the Department of Justice should be looking at changing within the justice system. You know, starting with the Yates memo, which is a prescription to all of the prosecutors to go after the CEOs and make it a criminal investigation from the start. You know, from that to the Park Doctrine, where CEOs are responsible, strict liability for criminal actions of their employees. So something that I didn't do, that I didn't tell anyone to do, that I didn't even know they did, if someone creates a crime within my company and I have responsibility and authority to prevent or correct it, I'm responsible for that crime. I go to prison for the crime of the employee, and I always allege it, analogize it to teenagers. Sales reps, I think, are a lot like teenagers. They have the same motivation, the same maturity level in a lot of cases. Take 100 teenagers and say, if they commit a crime, you're the one going to jail? No one would sleep.
No way.
You would not sleep.
Yeah.
No way.
Yeah.
But that's what
they
do with me and the sales reps. Even if I told them not to do something, if they did it, if I have the power and responsibility to prevent or correct it, I go to prison. And that's no one who was aware of that is willing to accept it. And the only reason my fellow CEOs in medical device land actually continue to do the job is they just close their eyes. They just don't want to listen to it. When I give a talk to them, they don't want to hear it.
One of the reasons I picked up on your case is that the Wall Street Journal did an editorial when you won the case that was outstanding. And what I want to know is, I mean, it was a wonderful thing that they you know, I don't know how the communication worked, but they... you know, they really nailed it. And so you got some good coverage. I don't know how that Wall Street Journal article happened so quickly, but it was a great thing.
Yeah, we had King & Spalding was our law firm out of D.C., which is helpful, and they are kind of knowledgeable in that way. And William McGurn at the Wall Street Journal is kind of on this issue, and he likes that. And they got the information to him, and he picked up on it, and he wrote that op-ed. It was, you know, justice for justice or no justice for business about our prosecution and going against the Department of Justice. And the best thing about that editorial, this is one that I liked, but I didn't realize how much I liked it until I heard the blowback from the prosecutors, is the one thing the prosecutors don't like is when you use their name. If they win, they want their name everywhere. But if they lose and use their name, So, you know, Bud Paulsen and Tim Finley and Christine Platon and Charles Bureau, we named them by name in the press release.
Right.
And William McGurn picked it up. And by name, they were in the Wall Street Journal about how they
Fabulous.
Were part of a failed prosecution. And that's the thing I heard that they like, that was the one they hated the most. They wanted to be so far removed from this case, they wanted to moonwalk out of the courtroom and forget about it forever. And all of a sudden, there's their name as the Department of Justice people who bungled this entire investigation and prosecution.
Well, then what happened was I picked up the Wall Street Journal and saw your article 2 weeks ago. And I had not realized that you'd written cardiac arrest. So, of course, I immediately got it and found the website. But that was another great one. I don't know if it's publicly available.
Yeah, it is. There's a paywall for Wall Street Journal. But if you Google it, Google Howard Root Wall Street Journal, you'll find it and be
It'll
able to
up.
Read it that way. But this was one that was just like every employee's dream is to put your resignation letter in the Wall Street Journal. Right? And I got to do it. And it was a strange quirk of things. It's on the Yates memo. Sally Yates wrote this memo that tells prosecutors to go after CEOs of companies on healthcare fraud. And Sally Yates is the one who got fired because she disobeyed Trump's order on immigration. So I wrote a draft of this, which was, you know, you fired Sally Yates, now fire the Yates memo. And I thought,
right.
Oh, there's the hook. So I sent that in to the Wall Street Journal. Nothing from them for a week. And then when I hear back from them, they said, well, it doesn't really work for us because that's yesterday's news. That's why I wrote it last week. It was yesterday's news. It would have been good to publish it then. But then they said, but, you know, if you turn this around a little bit and you talk about what happened to you and then go in to get rid of the Yates memo, well, that one sounds interesting. I thought, well, that's great because that's what I wanted to do in the first place. So I wrote it and I said, here's the article, but you can't publish it until Friday the 17th because that's my last day of employment. I said, okay, we'll run out of that day. So on my last day of employment, my Wall Street Journal had my editorial in it, which started with the first sentence, I quit. And that one will be up on my wall for the rest of my life. That was
a good one. Well-deserved. Okay, so let's talk about in the one of the last chapters of the book, you talk about the criminalization of America. Talk about the criminalization of America. You have a list of great proposals as to what we could do, and maybe if we could just quickly go through them, because I think there are many things we could do, and it's time to do them.
Right. And one that I add after I wrote the book was about this Yates memo. So I think that's the easiest thing to do because that's an internal Department of Justice policy.
Right.
That tells prosecutors how to approach justice, and it should not be a return on investment. It should completely rewrite it, say that you are about justice, not about money, not about convictions, but about getting the right result for the right people. Tear up the Yates memo, rewrite it, easy to be done, and I hope Attorney General Sessions does that. The second thing is to eliminate this whole entire concept of strict liability crimes, that if something happens that you can put someone in prison, even if that person didn't do the act, tell anyone to do the act, know that the act occurred or intend to do the act at all. It's completely opposite to American justice. For a criminal violation, for civil violations, for penalties, for things like that, that's fine. But when we talk about criminal violations and destroying people for strict liability, that's a judicial principle that should be ruled to be unconstitutional. And there's a case coming up that has a good chance for that. Then within the Department of Justice, I think there's some other changes that could be made. One is I think there should be an independent review of every single indictment, that a prosecutor should not get the independent authority to bring an indictment against an individual without an independent lawyer in the Department of Justice looking over it and saying, okay, I agree. Because the indictment itself is the punishment. The process can be the punishment. And when 99% of Americans can't withstand the indictment, the Department of Justice has to look at that as if it's a sentence, and they can't just say, well, try it out in court, because you're destroying people without any chance for them to defend themselves.
Well, but there's something else. If you're shaking somebody down for a settlement, you know, you shouldn't be able to indict without evidence. And too often I've seen cases where they had no evidence. You know, they just knew that they could do irreparable harm before the defendant could afford to put forward a legitimate case, and so they go forward. And I think this step is very important. If you get an independent attorney having to review and affirm the evidence, a lot of those cases can't go forward.
Right. Absolutely.
Right.
And then I think they should prohibit all Department of Justice publicity before the conviction. Now, they can say we brought charges against someone, but they go far beyond that now. They
Yes.
have press release with quote after quote after quote about how bad the defendant is. And then at the end they say, well, an indictment is an allegation only, truth or falsity is proven in a court of law. Well, that doesn't do any
Right.
good. The newspaper picks this
Right.
up. And in my case, my hometown newspaper, lead story, front page, not of the business section, of the whole paper, medical device CEO accused of fraud. That's
Right.
And then 15 months later is when I get the exoneration. Well, I was born here.
Right.
I was raised here, went to school here. Everybody, you know, who I know lives here. And for a year and a quarter, I walk around and they're looking at me thinking I'm going to go to prison because I must have done something wrong. And so
Right.
many people in America think if the government brings charges against someone, they must have done something wrong. The government wouldn't do that without cause. And it's now, for me, it's just opened my eyes. You know,
Right.
the interesting thing for us is the best juror, we did 3 mock trials, and we found out who is the best, you know, background of a juror. So we were down in San Antonio, so you have Hispanic, white, African-American, older is over 50, middle-aged 30 to 50, young is under 30, and then male and female. And we looked at that, and I was always thinking, well, who is going to resonate with me? Who's going to see my story and not want to throw me in prison? Who's going to see the government for what it was? And I was completely wrong. The group that most resonated with me, that would never throw me in prison, the ones who would say the government is bad and the defendants are good, are older, male or female, African-Americans.
Right.
Because as soon as they see anything about prosecutorial misconduct and making threats to individuals, they've seen it before. You know, I'm
Right.
a 56-year-old white guy in Minnesota. My family hasn't been harassed by the government before this. I don't think that happens that often. But the African-Americans
Right.
have seen it in their community all the time, and
Right.
that's what resonates with them. But
Right.
this whole idea that the publicity from a DOJ indictment can destroy someone is awful.
Well, what they're doing, and it goes back to the, you said 90%, you know, fold economically at that time. What you're doing with the publicity is you're engaging in economic warfare and destroying their ability to defend themselves.
Absolutely,
so
well said.
Yeah.
It is.
Okay.
It's exactly that. So then, you know, the other things that I have is if there is prosecutorial misconduct, it should go through an independent agency. Right now, we make allegations of what these prosecutors did. Those allegations go into the Department of Justice to investigate itself. It should go
Right.
to the Office of Inspector General outside so they can investigate it. And then if they are guilty of misconduct, we should be able to get our attorney's fees back from them. Now, there is an amendment. There's a law. It's called the Hyde Amendment, not the one related to abortion, a different one, that says that if you're the subject of a malicious prosecution, you can sue the government to get your legal expenses back, which sounds like justice, right? Except that when it was implemented, they wanted to make sure that rich people could not take advantage of it. So if you have a net worth as a corporation over $7 million or of an individual
mm-hmm.
over $2 million, you cannot take advantage of the Hyde Amendment. Well, we spent $25 million. So what company with a net worth under $7 million could fight a malicious prosecution?
So let me ask you, do you think it would be possible to instead just increase the limits significantly? And I'll tell you why, because you have a certain group of contractors in Washington who are so big and so, in terms of revenues and profits, enormous. Most
Yep.
prosecutors are terrified to even, no matter how much evidence they have.
Right.
And one of the reasons is, you know, if you took the Hyde Amendment to, you know, basically off, none of those companies, or very rarely would any of those companies ever be prosecuted. It would be very chilling for them.
Well, the standard is high, and there isn't enough law to figure out where that is, but it's got to be a
Right.
very malicious prosecution. It can't be just a loser if they lose against
Right.
them. It's got to be something where you go to trial and the defendant wins, as in our case, where you don't call any witnesses. So if the
Right.
standard's high enough, in my view, everyone should be able to take advantage of it. You shouldn't exclude
Okay.
rich people from taking advantage of it.
Right.
But the standard has to be higher than just
Very
they
high.
Made a mistake. It's that they knew what
Right.
they were doing and they did the wrong thing. And if we just had that, I think it's very easy for prosecutors to pick the cases to prosecute. It's just they've got choices all over the place. They don't have to prosecute anything. And so if they're picking right. only the ones where really crimes have occurred, they won't have to worry about maliciousness. They won't have to worry about the Hyde Amendment at all. And then reforming this whistleblower cash grab, where these whistleblowers can get hundreds of millions of dollars for just bringing an allegation against a company, incentivizes them to create fictional fictional situations. And we see that all day long right. in healthcare, and I think we're seeing it in the financial community as well, where disgruntled former employees are creating things and acting like they're doing the noble cause by ratting out the corporation on things that are completely made up.
They're teeing up government greenmail. They're saying, okay, you can go shake this company down and get some money, and I'll get some money, and then they'll pay us to go away. I think you had the statistics for how many of these cases settle.
Well, it's 97%, I think, is the percentage that settle.
Right.
And you get over 95% on anything, and it's almost, that's a fact. That's a certainty in statistics, and it's a certainty, we're such the outlier. The only reason we did fight is because they never gave us an option of settling by just paying money. We had to have money and bodies, and when they do that, then you say, okay, now it's something we can fight. Now it's something we want to fight. We're not going to agree to that.
Right. Yeah, they were very piggish, which was a mistake on their part.
They could have gotten $20 million if they wanted. I would have given them that for something that wasn't a crime. I would have said, fine,
right.
because I don't want to get indicted. I don't want to go through jail. I don't want to go through through a trial and the potential of prison if a jury doesn't like me. But instead, they wanted $20 million, plus they wanted me excluded, and that was never going to happen.
One of the things I really enjoyed in the book is when you get frustrated with your attorneys because they're behaving, you had one group that was behaving like, I used to call it Job of the Hutt. We get appointed and the thing is going to settle, but we just have to wait it out. And then it settles and we get a big cash payout and we don't prepare for trial because nobody ever goes to trial.
Right. Yeah.
And you're preparing to go for trial and you feel like you're pushing this mountain. It's like pushing a stone up a mountain, and luckily you were able to fire them. But
with prosecutors like these, deals get better closer to trial. And with that kind of attitude, why would you even think about preparing for trial? Because you're going to settle. And his view was everything settles. And when it got to a point where the only settlement was me pleading guilty or me being excluded, he thought maybe the company was going to take it. And we said, no, he wasn't ready to do anything. He hadn't done anything. He just sent the bill and done very, very little. So that's why he quit, because he wasn't willing to accept his mistake, and it's easier for him to just walk away. And then you're left 3 years into a process saying, we better get a good lawyer here because we're going to be in court.
Right, and you have to train them all the way from the beginning again.
Right, so. and educate them on the medical procedure, on the product, on who we are, who the employees are. It's painful to have to bring new lawyers up to speed on this. It's expensive as well, but the expense, we had plenty of money. That was the one blessing we had, but we didn't have all the time in the world. And while we were doing that, as you said, I still had to run a company. We still had a public company. We had shareholders. We had products to launch. We had sales meetings to hold.
Right.
Regulatory compliance, all kinds of other issues. So while one hand you're out fighting the government, the other hand has to be juggling three balls of a public company.
I have to tell you, I find Cardiac Arrest to be one of the most inspiring books I've read in a long time, because when you put it down, you say, here's someone who really fought back, and in so doing, and the way you did it, including getting the publicity that you got, really did a service for everybody. And I think, something like this has to put an enormous chill through everybody at the Department of Justice saying, well, maybe we can't just, there's risk in just shaking people down when there's no evidence. So
I hope that's true. I'm not sure the Department of Justice is looking at our case like that yet, but if I could get in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee and talk to them and get a little bit more publicity in Washington, D.C. so they knew it, and if Senator Sessions or Attorney General Sessions did it, that's the goal. That's the ultimate part, is cultural change.
Here's what I want. I want every subscriber to go check the current members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. And if you have a senator on that committee, I want you to buy the book and mail it with a letter asking that the senator and his staff read Cardiac Arrest. I assure you they will not be disappointed. How about that?
That'd be great. Yeah. I've sent one to Senator Klobuchar. I'm out in D.C. the week of April 1st, and I've got some meetings with representatives from Minnesota, but we're trying to get a meeting with Attorney General Sessions. I mean, D.C. is crazy now with all the new stuff with the Trump administration, but this is, you know, this is a relevant issue at the right time and the right administration to be something that I think can relatively easily be, I wouldn't say fixed, but improved. It's always a balancing with justice. But it's so far off to one side that we could make a massive shift toward justice and away from, I'll call it what it is, extortion. And that's what the Department of Justice does to businesses every day.
Well, Howard Root, you're making America great again, and we really appreciate it.
Thanks, Captain. I appreciate it. It resonates with some people, and it certainly resonates with you, and I'm glad it does.
Yeah.
It's something that it woke up my eyes going through the process, and I'm trying to, hopefully other people are aware of what can happen now, too.
Well, thank you very much. Just take 1 second and tell us, tell everybody about how to find the website for Cardiac Arrest, and then tell us a little bit more about Howard Root's future. How do we keep up with you?
Yeah, so the website is cardiacarrestbook.com, and there I have links to where you can buy the book, hardcover and paperback, and paperback is on Amazon. Although Amazon, it keeps selling out on Amazon, so it keeps getting pushed back a little bit. But there's other places there if you go to the website to get the book. And Kindle, obviously, Kindle is available, immediate download there. And the audiobook should be coming out here in about a month. I think they're done with it, and it's in post-production now, and it should be coming out. I'm also on Twitter, at Root Howard, and you can follow a link to some presentations and some articles and some other things about it. And I've got some speaking things coming up as well. And we're going to be doing some more speaking. Now that I'm second week into retirement, I'm putting full time into the book and the promotion, which is kind of, it's a lot of fun. I have a publicist and we're working on booking some things. And so that's a lot of fun.
Good.
For me personally, it is bittersweet to sell the company because at 56, I thought I had at least 10 more years, if not 15.
Right.
But making a solid break, you know, selling the company and then walking away the same day was the right way to do it. And now I've made that break. And so this is my issue. I'm a political guy in the sense of an issues guy. I'm not a political guy in terms of the system and the politics. I don't like that. But as a business person, interested in issues, this is my first issue, and there's some other issues behind it, I think, that I'm going to get involved in, because I'm not going to go John Galt, I'm not going to disappear, but at the other time, I'm not going to put myself in harm's way, and I think there is a balance there between not trying to do everything, but do the important things in the time that we have. I'm way too young to not do anything, and my golf game is way too bad to ever improve, so I want to do something important. And we'll see how that goes.
Okay. Well, if we can ever help you here at the Salary Report, we would be delighted to do it. So just if there's anything we can do, you let us know. Okay.
I appreciate that. I will do that. I appreciate it a lot.
Have a great day.
Thanks, Catherine.